God help me. I'll see you gentlemen tomorrow. He left. Fraser and Punt were alone. The inspector is absolutely correct, Punt said. You mean there are too many suspects? He asks whether the same person killed Sir Magnus Pye and his housekeeper. Everything rests on that. Clearly there is a connection between the two deaths, but we are no closer to discovering what it is. And until then, we will remain in the dark. But perhaps the answer now lies in my hands. He looked at the first page and smiled. Already the handwriting is known to me.
How?
But Punt didn't answer. He had begun to read. Part 5. Silver. Chapter 1. Detective Inspector Chubb very much liked the police station in Orange Grove, Bath. It was a perfect Georgian construction, solid and serious, yet at the same time light and elegant enough to feel welcoming, at least if you were on the right side of the law. He couldn't enter it without a sense that his work mattered, and that by the end of the day, the world might be a slightly better place. His office was on the first floor, overlooking the main entrance. Sitting at his desk, he could look out of a window that stretched the full height of the room, and this too gave him a sense of comfort. He was, after all, the eye of the law. It was only right that he should have a view that was so expansive. He had brought John Whitehead to this room. It was a deliberate move to winkle the man out of the false shell that Saxby-on-Avon had provided, and to remind him who was in charge. There were to be no lies told here. In fact, there were four people facing him: Whitehead, his wife, Atticus Punt, and his young assistant, Fraser. He normally had a photograph of Mrs. Chubb on the desk, but he had slid it into a drawer just before they came in. He wasn't quite sure why.
"Your name is John Whitehead," he began.
"That's right."
The antique dealer was sullen and downcast. He knew the game was up. He wasn't trying to disguise it.
"And you came to Saxby-on-Avon how long ago?"
3 years.
"We've done nothing wrong,"
Gemma Whitehead cut in. She was such a small woman, the seat looked much too big for her. She was cradling a handbag in her lap. Her feet barely touched the floor.
"You know who he is and what he's done, but he's left all that behind him. He served his time and he was let out for good behaviour. We moved out of London just to be together somewhere quiet. And all this business with Sir Magnus, that had nothing to do with us."
"I think you should let me be the judge of that," Chubb replied.
Mary Blakiston's diary was lying on the desk in front of him, and for a moment he was tempted to open it. But there was no need. He already knew the relevant contents well enough.
"On the 9th of July, a certain Arthur Reeve had his home broken into. Mr. Reeve used to be the landlord at the Queen's Arms, and is now living in retirement with his wife. A window was broken, and he was very distressed to find that his medal collection, including a rare George VI Greek medal, had been stolen from his front room. The entire collection was valued at £100 or more, although, of course, it had great sentimental value, too."
Whitehead drew himself up. But next to him, his wife had paled. She was hearing this for the first time.
"Why are you telling me this?" he demanded. "I don't know anything about any medal."
"The thief cut himself on the window," Chubb said. "One day later, on the 10th of July, you were treated by Dr. Redwing," Punt added. "You required stitches for an unpleasant cut on your hand." He smiled briefly to himself. In the landscape of this particular crime, two minor byways had just reached a crossroads.
"I cut my hand in the kitchen," Johnny said.
He glanced at his wife, who did not look convinced.
"I never went anywhere near Mr. Reeve or his medal. It's a pack of lies."
"What can you tell us about the visit Mary Blakiston made to you on the 11th
of July, 4 days before she died.
Who told you that? Have you been watching me?
Do you deny it?
What's there to deny?
Yes, she came into the shop. Lots of people come into the shop. She never said a thing about any medals.
Then maybe she talked to you about the money that you had paid to Brent.
Punt had spoken softly, reasonably, but there was something in his tone that suggested he knew everything, that there was no point arguing. In fact, Fraser knew this wasn't true. The groundsman had done his best to cover his tracks. He had said the £5 was owed to him, perhaps for work he had done. Punt was taking a stab in the dark. However, his words had an immediate effect.
All right, Whitehead admitted. She did come in, nosing around, asking me questions, just like you.
What are you trying to say? That I pushed her down the stairs to shut her up?
Johnny!
Gemma Whitehead let out a cry of exasperation.
It's all right, love.
He reached out to her, but she twisted away.
I've done nothing wrong. Brent came into the shop a couple of days after Mary's funeral. He had something to sell. It was a silver belt buckle, Roman, a nice little piece, I'd say about 4th century BC. He wanted 20 quid for it. I gave him 5.
When was this?
I can't remember. Monday. It was the week after the funeral.
Did Brent say where he got it from?
Chubb asked.
No.
Did you ask him?
Why should I have?
You must have been aware that there'd been a burglary at Pye Hall only a few days before. A collection of silver jewellery and coins was stolen from Sir Magnus. It was the same day as Mrs. Blakiston's funeral.
I did hear about that.
Yes.
And you didn't put 2 and 2 together?
Whitehead drew a breath.
A lot of people come into my shop. I buy a lot of things. I bought a set of Worcester coffee mugs off Mrs. Reeve and a brass carriage clock off the Finches, and that was just last week. Do you think I asked them where they got them? If I went around treating everyone in Saxby like criminals, I'd be out of business in a week.
Chubb drew a breath.
But you are a criminal, Mr. Whitehead. You did 3 years in prison for receiving stolen goods.
You promised me,
Gemma muttered. You promised you weren't going back to all that.
Stay out of it, love. They're just trying to wind me up.
Whitehead glanced balefully at Chubb.
You've got it all wrong, Mr. Chubb. Yes, I bought a silver belt buckle off Brent. Yes, I knew there's been a break-in at Pye Hall. But did I put 2 and 2 together? No, I didn't. Call me stupid if you like, but there's no crime in stupidity. And for all I know, he could have had it in his family for 20 years. If you're saying it was stolen from Sir Magnus, then your argument is with Brent, not with me.
Where is the belt buckle now?
I sold it to a friend in London. And for rather more than £5, I'll be bound. That's my business, Mr. Chubb. That's what I do.
Atticus Punt had been listening to all this in silence. Now he adjusted his glasses and observed, quietly, Mrs. Blakiston visited you before the break-in at Pye Hall. It was the theft of the medal that interested her. Did she threaten you?
She was a nosy cow, asking questions about things that had nothing to do with her.
Did you purchase any other items from Brent?
No, that's all he had. If you want to find the rest of Sir Magnus's treasure trove, maybe you should be searching his place instead of wasting your time with me.
Punt and Chubb exchanged a glance. There was clearly nothing more to be gained from the interview. Even so, the detective inspector was determined to have the last word.
There have been a number of petty thefts in Saxby-on-Avon since you arrived, he said. Windows broken, antiques and jewellery gone missing. I can promise you we'll be looking into every one of them. And I'm going to want a record of everything you've bought and sold in the past 3 years, too.
I don't keep records.
The tax office may take a dim view of that.
I hope you're not planning on going anywhere in the next few weeks, Mr. Whitehead.
We'll be in touch again.
The antique dealer and his wife got up and left the room, showing themselves out.
Ahead of them, there was an upper landing and then a staircase leading down. They continued in silence, but the moment they were in the open air, Gemma burst out.
Oh, Johnny, how could you lie to me?
I didn't lie to you, Johnny replied miserably.
After everything we talked about, all the plans we had.
It was as if she hadn't heard him. Who did you see when you were in London? This silver belt buckle of yours, who did you sell it to?
I told you.
You mean Derek and Colin? Did you tell them about Mary? Did you tell them she was onto you?
What are you talking about?
You know what I mean. In the old days, when you were part of the gang, if people stepped out of line, things happened. We never mentioned it, and I know you weren't part of it, but we both know what I'm talking about. People disappeared.
What? You think I took out a contract on Mary Blakiston to get her off my back?
Well, did you?
Johnny Whitehead didn't answer. They walked to their car in silence. Chapter 2. A search of Brent's house had produced nothing that related either to the murderer or the stolen treasure trove. Brent lived on his own in a row of terraced houses in Daphne Road, a simple two-up, two-down that shared a porch with its neighbour, the two front doors meeting at an angle. From the outside, the building had a certain chocolate box charm. The roof was thatched, the wisteria and the flower beds well cared for. The interior told another story. Everything had a sense of neglect, from the unwashed dishes in the sink to the unmade bed and the clothes thrown carelessly on the floor. A certain smell lingered in the air, one that Chubb had come upon many times before, and which always made him frown. It was the smell of a man living alone. There was nothing in the house that was new or luxurious, and everything had a make-do-and-mend quality, years after those words had gone out of fashion. Plates were chipped, chairs held together by string. Brent's parents had once lived here, and he had done nothing to the place since they had died. He even slept in the same single bed with the same blanket and eiderdown that must have been his as a boy. There were comics on the bedroom floor, too, and Scout magazines. It was as if Brent had never fully grown up, and if he had stolen the entire hoard of Sir Magnus's Roman silver, he clearly hadn't sold it yet. He had just £100 in his bank account. There was nothing hidden in the house, not under the floorboards, in the attic, up the chimney. The police had done a thorough search.
"I didn't take it. I didn't do it. It wasn't me."
Brent had been brought home in a police car from Pye Hall and was sitting with a look of shock on his face, surrounded by policemen who had invaded the shabby sanctity of his home. Atticus Punt and James Fraser were among them.
"Then how did you come upon the silver belt buckle that you sold to John Whitehead?"
Chubb asked.
"I found it,"
Brent continued hurriedly as the detective inspector's eyes glazed in disbelief.
"It's the truth. It was the day after the funeral, a Sunday. I don't work the weekend, not as a rule, but Sir Magnus and Lady Pye, they'd only just got back from their holiday, and I thought they might need me. So I went down the hall just to show Willing, and I was in the garden when I saw it shining on the lawn. I didn't have any idea what it was, but it looked old, and there was a picture of a man carved into it, standing there with no clothes." He smirked briefly, as if sharing a rude joke. "I popped it into my pocket, and then on the Monday I took it into Mr. Whitehead, and he gave me a fiver for it. It was twice what I was expecting."
"Yes, and half what it was worth," Chubb thought. "There were police called into Pye Hall that day," he said. "Sir Magnus reported a burglary. What do you have to say about that?"
"I left before lunchtime. I didn't see any police."
"But you must have heard about the break-in."
"I did, but by then it was too late. I'd already sold what I'd found to Mr. Whitehead, and maybe he'd sold it too. I looked in the shop window and it wasn't there."
Brent shrugged.
"I've done nothing wrong."
That much was questionable. But even Chubb would have been forced to admit that Brent's crime was a very minor one, if, that is, he was telling the truth.
"Where did you find the buckle?" he asked. "It was in the grass, in front of the house."
Chubb glanced at Punt,
as if asking for guidance.
It would be interesting, I think, to see the exact spot, Pump said.
Chub agreed, and the four of them left together, Brent complaining all the while as he was carried back to Pye Hall. Once again they drove past the lodge house with its two stone griffins, almost seeming to whisper to each other, and for a moment Fraser was reminded of the game that the two boys, Robert and Tom Blakiston, had played together at night, the code words that they had rapped out to each other when they were in bed. It suddenly struck him that the game had a significance he had overlooked, but before he could mention it to Punt, they had arrived. Brent called to them to stop, and they pulled in about halfway up the drive, opposite the lake. "It was over here." He led them across the lawn. In front of them, the lake stretched out, dank and oily with the woodland behind. Perhaps it was the story that Robert had told them earlier, but there was something indisputably evil about it. The brighter the sun, the blacker the water appeared. They stopped about 15 or 20 feet from the edge, Brent pointing down, as if he remembered the exact spot. "It was here."
"Just lying here?"
Chub sounded unconvinced.
"The sun was glinting off it. That's how I saw it."
Chub considered the possibilities.
"Well, I suppose if someone had been carrying a whole pile of the stuff, if they were on foot and in a hurry, they might have dropped a piece without noticing it."
"It is possible."
Punt was already working out the angles. He looked back at the driveway, the lodge house, the front door.
"And yet, it is strange, Detective Inspector. Why would the burglar come this way? He broke into the house through the back."
"That's right."
"Then, to reach the gate, it would have been faster to continue along the other side of the driveway."
"Unless they were heading for Dingle Dell."
The inspector examined the line of trees with the vicarage somewhere on the other side of the lake.
"No chance of being seen if they go out through the wood."
"That is true," Punt agreed. "And yet, you will forgive me, Detective Inspector, you are a thief. You are carrying a great many pieces of silver, jewelry and coins. Would you wish to make your way through thick woodland in the middle of the night?"
His eyes settled on the black surface.
"The lake holds many mysteries," he said. "I believe it has further stories to tell, and wonder if it would be possible for you to arrange an inspection by police divers. I have a suspicion, an idea."
He shook his head, as if dismissing the thought.
"Divers?" Chub shook his head. "That's going to cost a pretty penny or two. What is it exactly you're hoping to find?"
"The true reason why Pye Hall was burgled on the same evening as Mary Blakiston's funeral."
Chub nodded.
"I'll see to it." "Do you want anything else?" Brent asked.
"I will keep you only for a few moments more, Mr. Brent. I would like you to show us the door that was broken when the burglary took place."
"Yes, sir." Brent was relieved that the investigation seemed to be moving away from him. "We can cut across through the rose garden."
"There is one other question I wish to put to you," Punt said.
As they walked, Fraser noticed that the detective was leaning heavily on his stick.
"I understand that Sir Magnus had made it known to you that he wished to dispense with your employment."
Brent started as if stung.
"Who told you that? Is it true?"
"Yes."
The groundsman was scowling now. His whole body seemed to have become stooped, his curly hair flopping over his forehead.
"Why did you not mention this to me when we met?"
"You never asked me."
Punt nodded. That was fair enough.
"Why did he ask you to leave?"
"I don't know. But he was always on at me. Mrs. Blakiston used to complain about me. Them two, they were like Bob and Gladys Grove."
"It's a television program," Fraser said, overhearing. "The Grove family."
This was exactly the sort of thing that Fraser would know, and which Punt wouldn't.
"When did he tell you?"
"The day Sir Magnus died."
In other words, just before the first death. He must have given you a reason.
He gave me no reason, no good reason. I've been coming here ever since I was a boy. My father was here before me, and he'd come out here and just said that was the end of it.
They had come to the rose garden. It was surrounded by a wall with an entrance that was an arbor shaped out of dark green leaves. Beyond, there was crazy paving, a statue of a cherub, all the different roses, and a bench. And on the bench, Francis Pye and Jack Dartford were sitting, holding hands, engaged in a passionate kiss. Chapter 3. In fact, nobody was really very surprised. It had been obvious to Punt, and even to Fraser, that Lady Pye and her ex-tennis partner had been conducting an affair. What else could they possibly have been doing in London on the day of the murder? Chubb had known it too, and even the guilty parties only seemed mildly put out that they had been discovered in flagrante. It was going to happen sooner or later, so why not now? They were still on the bench, sitting slightly apart, facing the three men who stood over them. A smirking Brent had been sent on his way.
"I think you should explain yourself, Lady Pye," Chubb said.
"There's nothing really to explain," she replied coolly. "Jack and I have been seeing each other for almost 2 years. That day in London I was with him the whole time, but there was no shopping, no art galleries. After lunch we had a room at the Dorchester. Jack stayed with me until about 5:30. I left at 7. You can ask them if you don't believe me."
"You lied to me, Lady Pye."
"That was wrong of me, Detective Inspector, and I'm sorry. But the fact is, it doesn't make any real difference, does it? The rest of my story was true. Coming home on the train, arriving at 8:30, seeing the green car. Those are the salient points."
"Your husband is dead. You were deceiving him."
"I'd say those are also salient points, Lady Pye."
"It wasn't like that," Jack Dartford cut in. "She wasn't deceiving him. That's not how I saw it. Anyway, you have no idea what Magnus was like. The man was a brute. The way he treated her, his infantile rages, it was disgusting. And she gave up her career for him."
"What career was that?" Punt asked.
"In the theatre. Frances was a brilliant actress. I saw her on the stage long before I met her."
"That's enough, Jack," Frances cut in. "Is that where your husband met you? In the theatre?" Chubb asked.
"He sent flowers to my dressing room. He'd seen me as Lady Macbeth."
Even Chubb knew that one. A play in which a powerful woman persuades a man to commit murder.
"Were you ever happy together?" he asked.
She shook her head. "I knew very quickly that I'd made a mistake, but I was younger then, and I suppose I was too proud to admit it. The trouble with Magnus was that it wasn't enough for him to marry me. He had to own me. He made that clear very quickly. It was as if I were part of the package. The house, the grounds, the lake, the woods, and the wife. He was very old-fashioned, the way he saw the world."
"Was he ever violent to you?"
"Well, he never actually struck me, Detective Inspector, but violence can take many forms. He was loud, he could be threatening, and he had a way of throwing himself around that often made me afraid."
"Tell him about the sword," Dartford insisted.
"Oh, Jack."
"What happened with the sword, Lady Pye?" Chubb asked.
"It was just something that happened a couple of days before I went up to meet Jack. You must understand that underneath it all, Magnus was a great big child. If you ask me, this whole business with Dingle Dell was more about upsetting people than actually making money. He had temper tantrums. If he didn't get what he wanted, he could become very nasty indeed." She sighed. "He had a good idea that I was seeing someone all those trips to London, and the two of us were sleeping apart, of course. He didn't want me any more. Not in the way a husband wants his wife. But it hurt his pride that I might have actually found somebody else. We had a row that morning.
I can't even remember what started it. But then he started screaming at me how I was his, how he would never let me go. I'd heard it all before. Only this time he was crazier than ever. You noticed that there was a painting missing in the Great Hall? It was a portrait of me, which he'd commissioned as a present for my 40th birthday. As a matter of fact, it was done by Arthur Redwing.
She turned to Punt.
Have you met him?
He is married to the doctor?
Yes.
I have seen another work of his, but we have not yet met.
Well, I think he's very talented, and I love the painting he did of me. He actually managed to capture a moment of real happiness, standing in the garden near the lake. And that was rare enough, I can tell you. It was a gorgeous summer that year. Arthur did the painting over 4 or 5 sessions, and although Magnus hardly paid him anything for it, that was typical of him to be so mean, I think it was rather wonderful. We talked about putting it in for the summer exhibition, you know, at the Royal Academy. But Magnus wouldn't put me on show. That would mean sharing me. So it stayed on the wall in the main hall. And then we had that argument. I'll admit that I can be quite nasty when I want to be, and I certainly let him have a few home truths. Magnus went very red, as if he was going to burst. He always did have problems with his blood pressure. He drank too much, and he quite easily worked himself up into these rages. I told him I was going up to London. He refused to give me permission. I laughed at him and told him I didn't need his permission or anyone else's. Suddenly, he went over to that stupid suit of armour and with a great yell pulled out the sword.
The same sword with which he would later be killed?
Yes, Mr. Punt. He came over to me, dragging it behind him, and for a moment I thought he was going to attack me with it, but instead he suddenly turned it on the painting and stabbed it again and again in front of my eyes. He knew it would hurt me, losing it. At the same time, he was telling me I was his possession and that he could do the same to me at any time.
What happened next, Lady Pye?
I just went on laughing. Is that the best you can do? I remember shouting those words at him. I think I was a little hysterical. Then I went up to my room and slammed the door.
And the painting?
I was sad about that. It couldn't be mended, or maybe it could, but it would have been too expensive. Magnus gave it to Brent to put on the bonfire.
She fell silent. I'm glad he's dead, Jack Dartford muttered suddenly. He was a total bastard. He was never kind to anyone, and he made life a misery for Francis. I'd have done it myself if I'd had the nerve. But he's gone now, and we can start again. He reached out and took her hand. No more hiding. No more lying. We can finally have the life we deserve. Punt nodded at Chubb, and the three of them moved away from the rose garden and back across the lawn. There was no sign of Brent. Jack Dartford and Lady Pye had remained where they were.
I wonder where he was on the night of the murder, Fraser said.
You are referring to Mr. Dartford?
We only have his word for it that he stayed in London. He left the hotel at 5:30. That would have given him plenty of time to catch the train ahead of Lady Pye. It's just a thought.
You think him capable of murder?
I think he's a chancer. You can tell just by looking at him. He comes across an attractive woman who's being badly treated by her husband, and it seems to me that if you're going to cut somebody's head off, there has to be a better reason than saving a local wood, and those two had a better reason than anyone.
There is some truth in what you say, Punt agreed.
Their car was parked a short distance away from the front of the house, and they moved towards it slowly. Chubb, too, had noticed that Punt was resting more heavily on his walking stick. He had once thought that the detective only carried it as a fashion accessory. Today, he clearly needed it.
There's something I forgot to tell you, Mr. Punt, he muttered.
It was the first time the two of them had been alone since the interview with Robert Blakiston the evening before.
I will be interested to hear anything you have to say, Detective Inspector.
You remember that scrap of paper we found in the fireplace in Sir Magnus's study? You thought there might be part of a fingerprint on it?
I remember it very well.
There was a fingerprint. The bad news is, there wasn't enough of it left to be any use to us. It's certainly untraceable, and we probably won't even be able to match it to any of our known suspects.
That is a pity.
There is something, though. It turns out that the paper itself was stained with blood. The same blood type as Sir Magnus, for what it's worth, although we can't be 100% certain that it was his.
That is of great interest.
That's a great headache, if you ask me. How does it all add up? We've got a handwritten envelope and a typed-up death threat. This scrap of paper clearly didn't belong to either of them, and we have no way of knowing how long it had actually been in the grate. The blood would suggest it was thrown in the fire after the murder.
But where did it come from in the first place?
Exactly. Anyway, where do you want to go next?
I was hoping you might tell me, Inspector.
As a matter of fact, I was about to make a suggestion. I had a very interesting phone call from Dr. Redwing before I left the office last night.
Did you know her father's just died?
Natural causes, which makes a pleasant change.
Well, apparently, he had a bit of a story to tell. And I rather think we need to talk to Clarissa Pye.
Chapter 4
Clarissa Pye came into the living room carrying a tray with three cups of tea and some biscuits, neatly arranged on a plate, as if somehow the symmetry would make them more desirable. The room seemed terribly small with so many people in it. Atticus Punt and his assistant were next to each other on the faux leather sofa, their knees almost touching. The round-faced detective inspector from Bath had taken the armchair opposite. She could feel the walls hemming them in. But ever since Dr. Redwing had told her the news, the house had not been the same. It was not her house. This was not her life. It was as if she had been swapped for someone else in one of those Victorian novels she had always enjoyed.
"I suppose it was understandable that Dr. Redwing should tell you what her father said," she began. Her voice was a little prim. "Although it might have been considerate to inform me that she was going to make the call."
"I'm sure she believed she was acting for the best, Miss Pye," Chubb said.
"Well, I suppose it was only right that the police were informed. After all, whatever you may think of Dr. Reinhardt, he committed a crime."
She set the tray down. "He lied on the birth certificate. He delivered both of us, but I was the first. He should really be prosecuted." "He's gone somewhere far beyond the reach of the law."
"The reach of human law, certainly."
"You have had very little time to get used to all this," Punt remarked gently.
"Yes, I only heard it yesterday."
"I imagine it must have come as quite a shock to you."
"A shock? I'm not quite sure that's the word I would use, Mr. Punt. It's more like an earthquake. I remember Edgar Reinhardt very well. He was very much liked in the village, and he often came out to the house when Magnus and I were growing up. He never struck me as an evil man, and yet it really is a monstrous thing to have done. His lie took away my entire life. And Magnus, I wonder if he knew about it. He was always lording it over me, as if there was some terrific joke, and I was the only one who wasn't in the know. He threw me out of my own home, you know. I had to support myself in London and then in America, and all the time there was no need for it." She sighed. "I have been very much cheated."
"What will you do?"
"I will claim what is mine. Why not? I have a right to it."
Inspector Chubb looked uncomfortable. "That may not be as easy as you think, Miss Pye," he said. "From what I understand, Dr. Redwing was alone in the room with her father when he told her what he'd done. There were no witnesses to the conversation. I suppose there's always a chance you may find something in his papers. He may have written something down, but right now it'll just be your word."
"He may have told someone else."
He almost certainly told Sir Magnus, Punt cut in. He turned to the detective inspector. You remember the notepad that we found on his desk the day after he was killed? Ashton H. M.W., a girl. Now it is all clear. The call was received from Ashton House. Edgar Renard knew that he was dying and, out of a sense of guilt, telephoned Sir Magnus to explain that when he delivered the twins, the firstborn had, in fact, been a girl. The notepad also contained a number of crossings out. Sir Magnus was clearly perturbed by what he heard.
Well, that could explain something, Clarissa said, and there was real anger in her voice. He came to this very house, sat where you're sitting on the very day of his death, and he offered me a job at Pye Hall. He wanted me to move into the lodge house and take over from Mary Blakiston. Can you imagine it? Maybe he was afraid that the truth was about to come to light. Maybe he actually wanted to contain me. If I'd moved in, I might have been the one with my head lopped off my shoulders.
I wish you luck, Miss Pye, Chubb said. It's clearly a great injustice that's been done, and if you can find any other witnesses, that will certainly help your case. But if it doesn't offend you, I'd offer you this advice. You might be better off just accepting things as they are. You have a nice enough house here. You're well-known and respected in the village. It's none of my business, but sometimes you can spend so much time chasing something that you lose everything else while you're about it. Clarissa Pye looked puzzled.
Thank you for your advice, Inspector Chubb. However, I had assumed that the reason for this visit was that you had come to assist me. Dr. Renard committed a crime, and we only have his daughter's word that he wasn't actually paid for his trouble. At any event, I assume it is a matter you would wish to investigate.
I must be honest, that hadn't really occurred to me. Chubb was suddenly uncomfortable, looking to Punt for help. You must remember that there have been two unexplained deaths in this village, Miss Pye, Punt said. I can understand your wish that the police should investigate the events that took place at the time of your birth, and yet we are here on another matter. I would not wish to distress you any further in what is clearly a difficult time for you, but I am afraid that I must ask you a question in connection with the two deaths, of Sir Magnus and of Mary Blakiston. It concerns a vial of liquid that went missing from Dr. Redwing's surgery quite recently. The vial contained a poison, physostigmine. Would you know anything about that? Clarissa Pye's face went through a range of emotions, each one drawn so distinctly that they could have hung together like a series of portraits. First, she was shocked. The question had been so unexpected. How could they possibly have known? Then there was fear. Were there to be consequences? Then came indignation, perhaps manufactured. She was outraged that they should suspect her of such a thing. And finally, all within a split second, came acceptance and resignation. Too much had happened already. There was no point in denying it.
Yes, I took it, she said.
Why?
How did you know it was me, if you don't mind my asking?
Mrs. Blakiston saw you leaving the surgery. Clarissa nodded.
Yes, I saw her watching me. Mary had this extraordinary ability to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I don't know how she did it.
She paused.
Who else knows?
She kept the diary which Inspector Chubb has in his possession. As far as we are aware, she told nobody else. That made things easier.
I took it on an impulse, she said. I happened to find myself in the surgery on my own, and I saw the physostigmine on the shelf. I knew exactly what it was. I'd done some medical training before I went to America.
What did you want it for?
I'm ashamed to tell you, Mr. Punt. I know it was wrong of me, and I may have been just a little bit out of my mind. But in the light of what we've just been saying, you, of all people, will understand that very little in my life has worked out the way I wanted. It's not just Magnus and the house. I never married. I never had any real love, not even when I was young. Oh, yes, I have the church and I have the village. But there have been times when I found myself looking in the mirror and I've wondered, what's the point? What am I doing here? Why should I even want to go on? The Bible is very clear about suicide. It's the moral equivalent of murder. God is the giver of life. He gives and he takes away. That's from the book of Job. We have no right to take matters into our own hands. She stopped, and suddenly there was a hardness in her eyes. But there have been times when I have been very much in the shadows, when I have looked into the valley of death and wished I could enter. How do you think it's been for me, watching Magnus and Francis and Freddy? I used to live in that house. All that wealth and comfort was once mine. Forget the fact that it was actually stolen from me. I should never have come back to Saxby-on-Avon. It was mad of me to humiliate myself by returning to the Emperor's table. So the answer is, yes, I thought about killing myself. I took the physostigmine because I knew it would do the job quickly and painlessly. Where is it now? Upstairs? In the bathroom? I'm afraid I must ask you to give it to me. Well, I certainly don't need it now, Mr. Bunt. She spoke the words lightly, almost with a glint in her eye. Are you going to prosecute me for theft?
There won't be any need for that, Miss Pye, Chubb said. We'll just make sure it gets back to Dr. Redwing.
They left a few minutes later, and Clarissa Pye closed the front door, glad to be alone. She stood quite still, her breasts rising and falling, thinking over what had just been said. The business with the poison didn't matter. That wasn't important now. But it was strange that such a tiny theft should have brought them here when so much had been stolen from her. Would she be able to prove that Pye Hall was hers? Suppose the detective inspector was right. All she had were the words of a sick and dying man with no witnesses present in the room. No proof that he was actually sane when he spoke them. A legal case resting on 12 minutes that had ticked by more than 50 years ago. Where could she possibly begin? And did she actually want to? It was very strange, but Clarissa suddenly felt as if a weight had been lifted from her shoulders. The fact that Punt had taken the poison with him was certainly part of it. The physostigmine had been preying on her conscience for all manner of reasons, and she knew that she had regretted taking it from the very start. But it was more than that. She remembered what Chubb had said.
You might be better off just accepting things as they are. You have a nice enough house here. You're well known and respected in the village. She was respected. It was true. She was still a popular teacher at the village school. She always made the most profitable stall at the village fete. Everyone liked her flower displays at Sunday service. In fact, Robin Osborne had often said that he didn't know how he would manage without her. Could it be, perhaps, that now she knew the truth, Pye Hall no longer had the power to intimidate her? It was hers. It always had been. And at the end of the day, it hadn't been Magnus who had stolen it from her. It hadn't been fate. It had been her own father, a man she had always remembered with fondness, but who turned out to be antediluvian, a monster. Did she really want to fight him, to bring him back into her life when he had been so long below the ground? No. She could rise above it. She might visit Francis and Freddy at Pye Hall, and this time she would be the one in the know. The joke would be on them. With something close to a smile, she went into the kitchen. There was a tinned salmon rissole and some stewed fruit in the fridge. They would do very nicely for lunch.
Chapter 5.
I thought she took it extremely well, Emilio Redwing said. We weren't even sure at first if we should tell her, but now I'm glad we did.
Punt nodded. He and Fraser had come here alone, Inspector Chubb having returned to Pye Hall to meet the two police divers who had been summoned from Bristol, the nearest metropolis to have such a resource. They would be examining the lake that very day, although Punt already had a very good idea what they would find. He was sitting in the doctor's private office. Arthur Redwing was also present. He looked uncomfortable, as if he would rather be anywhere else.
Yes, Miss Pye is certainly a formidable person, Punt agreed.
So, how is your investigation going? Arthur Redwing asked. It was the first time Punt had met Dr. Redwing's husband, the man who had painted the portrait of Francis Pye, and also, quite clearly, that of the young boy which hung on the wall behind him now. The boy must be his son. He had the same dark, good looks, the slightly crumpled, very English features. And yet, the two of them were at odds. There had been some difficulty between them. Punt had always been interested in the unique relationship that exists between the portraitist and his subject. How there can never be secrets. It was true here. The way the boy had been painted, his pose, the nonchalance of his shoulders resting against the wall, one knee bent, hands in his pockets, all this suggested intimacy, even love. But Arthur Redwing had also captured something dark and suspicious in the boy's eyes. He wanted to be away.
"It is your son?" he asked.
"Yes," Arthur replied. "Sebastian. He's in London." The three words somehow contained a lifetime of disappointment.
"We don't see him very often, I'm afraid," Emilio Redwing added. "Arthur painted that when Sebastian was 15.
"It's terribly good," Fraser said. When it came to art, he was the expert, not Punt, and he was glad to have his moment in the sun.
"Do you exhibit?"
"I'd like to," Arthur mumbled.
"You were about to tell us about your investigation," Emilio Redwing cut in.
"Yes, indeed, Dr. Redwing," Punt smiled. "It is very nearly complete. I do not expect to spend more than 2 more nights in Saxby-on-Avon."
Fraser's ears pricked up when he heard this. He'd had no idea that Punt was so close, and wondered who had said what, and when, to provide the significant breakthrough.
He was keen to hear the solution to the crime, and he wouldn't be sorry to get back to the comfort of Tanner Court, either.
"Do you know who killed Sir Magnus?"
"I have, you might say, a theory. There are just 2 pieces of the jigsaw that are missing, and which, once found, will confirm what I believe."
"And what are those, if you don't mind us asking?"
Arthur Redwing had suddenly become very animated.
"I do not mind you asking at all, Mr. Redwing. The first is taking place almost as we speak, with the supervision of Inspector Chubb. 2 police frogmen are searching the lake at Pye Hall."
"What do you expect them to find? Another body?"
"I hope nothing as sinister as that."
It was evident he was not going to expand any further.
"What about the other piece of the jigsaw?" Dr. Redwing asked.
"There is a person to whom I wish to speak. He may not know it, but I believe that he holds the key to everything that has taken place here in Saxby-on-Avon."
"And who is that?"
"I am referring to Matthew Blakiston. He was the husband of Mary Blakiston and, of course, the father of the 2 boys, Robert and Tom."
"Are you looking for him now?"
"I have asked Inspector Chubb to make inquiries."
"But you know he was here."
Dr. Redwing seemed almost amused.
"I saw him myself in the village. He came to his wife's funeral."
"Robert Blakiston did not tell me that."
"He may not have seen him. I didn't recognize him at first. He was wearing a hat that he kept very low over his face. He didn't talk to anyone and he kept right at the back. He also left before the end."
"Did you tell anyone this?"
"Well, no. Dr. Redwing seemed surprised by the question. It seemed perfectly natural for him to be there. He and Mary Blakiston had been married for a long time, and it wasn't hatred that drove them apart. It was grief. They lost a child. I was a little sorry that he chose not to speak to Robert, and he could have met Joy while he was there. It's a great shame, really. Mary's death could so easily have brought them all together.
"He might have been the one who killed her," Arthur Redwing exclaimed. He turned to Punt. "Is that why you want to see him? Is he a suspect?"
"That is impossible to say until I have spoken to him," Punt replied diplomatically. "So far, Inspector Chubb has been unable to locate him."
"He's in Cardiff," Dr. Redwing said.
For once, Punt was taken by surprise. "I don't have his address, but I can easily help you find him. I had a letter a few months ago from a GP in Cardiff. It was perfectly routine. He wanted some notes about an old injury that one of his patients had incurred. It was Matthew Blakiston. I sent him what he wanted and forgot all about it."
"You remember the GP's name?"
"Of course. It's on file. I'll get it for you." But before she could move, a woman suddenly appeared, letting herself into the surgery through the main door. The door of Dr. Redwing's office was open, and they all saw her. A woman in her 40s, plain, round-faced. Her name was Diana Weaver, and she had come to the surgery to clean it, as she did every day. Punt had known exactly when she would be arriving. It was she whom he had actually come to see. For her part, she was surprised to find anyone here so late in the day.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Redwing," she called out. "Would you like me to come back tomorrow?"
"No, please come in, Mrs. Weaver."
The woman came into the private office. Atticus Punt stood up, offering her his seat, and she sat down looking around her nervously. "Mrs. Weaver," he began, "allow me to introduce myself."
"I know who you are," she cut in.
"Then you will know why it is I wish to speak to you." He paused. He had no wish to upset this woman, and yet it had to be done. On the day of his death, Sir Magnus Pye received a letter relating to the new houses that he proposed to build. This would have caused the destruction of Dingle Dell. I wonder if you can tell me. Did you write that letter? She said nothing, so he went on. I have discovered that the letter was typed on the machine that sits in this surgery, and that only three people might have had access to it. Joy Sanderling, Dr. Redwing, and yourself. He smiled. I should add that you have nothing to worry about. It is not a crime to send a letter of protest, even if the language is a little intemperate. Nor do I suspect for a single minute that you followed through the threats that were made in the letter. I simply need to know how it got there, and so I ask you again. Did you write it? Mrs. Weaver nodded. There were tears beading at her eyes.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I can understand that you were upset, quite justifiably, about the loss of the woodland. We just hated seeing the village being knocked about for no good reason. I was talking about it with my husband and with my father-in-law. They've been in Saxby all their lives. We all have, and it's a very special place. We don't need new houses here. There's no call for them. And the Dell? You start there. Where does it end? You look at Torbury and Market Basing, roads and traffic lights and the new supermarkets. They've been hollowed out, and now people just drive through them and... She stopped herself. I'm sorry, Dr. Redwing, she said. I should have asked your permission. I acted in the heat of the moment. It doesn't matter, Emilia Redwing said. I really don't mind. In fact, I agree with you.
When did you deliver the letter? Punt asked.
It was Thursday afternoon. I just walked up to the door and popped it through.
Mrs. Weaver lowered her head. The next day, when I heard what had happened, Sir Magnus murdered, I didn't know what to think. I wished then that I hadn't sent it.
It wasn't like me to be so impulsive. I promise you, sir, I really didn't mean anything ill by it.
Again, the letter has no relevance to what occurred, Punt assured her.
But there is something I must ask you, and you must think very carefully before you answer. It concerns the envelope in which the letter was placed, and in particular, the address.
Yes, sir?
But Punt did not speak. Something very strange had happened. He had been standing in the middle of the room, partly resting on his walking stick, but as he had continued the interview with Mrs. Weaver, it had been noticeable that he was relying on it more and more. Now, very slowly, he was toppling to one side. Fraser noticed it first and leapt up to catch him before he hit the floor. He was just in time. As he reached him, the detective's legs buckled and his whole body slid away. Dr. Redwing was already out of her seat. Mrs. Weaver was staring in alarm. Atticus Punn's eyes were closed. His face was white. He didn't seem to be breathing at all. Chapter 6 Dr. Redwing was with him when he woke up. Punt was lying on the raised bed that the doctor used to examine patients. He had been unconscious for less than 5 minutes. She was standing over him, a stethoscope around her neck. She looked relieved to see that he had awoken.
"Don't move," she said. "You were taken ill."
"You have examined me?" Punt asked.
"I checked your heart and your pulse. It may just have been exhaustion."
"It was not exhaustion." There was a shooting pain in his temple, but he ignored it. "You do not need to concern yourself, Dr. Redwing. I have a condition that was explained to me by my doctor in London. He also gave me medication. If I might rest here a few more minutes, I would be grateful to you. But there is nothing more you can do for me."
"Of course you can stay here," Dr. Redwing said.
She was still looking into Punt's eyes.
"Is it inoperable?" she asked.
"You see what others do not. In the world of medicine, it is you who are the detective." Punt smiled a little sadly. "I am told that nothing can be done."
"Have you had a second opinion?"
"I do not need one. I know that there is not very much time left to me. I can feel it."
"I'm so sorry to hear it, Mr. Punt."
She thought for a moment.
"Your colleague did not seem to be aware of the problem."
"I have not informed Fraser, and I would prefer it if it remained that way."
"You need have no concern. I asked him to leave. Mrs. Weaver and my husband went with him. I told him I would walk over to the Queen's Arms with you as soon as you were feeling well enough."
"I am feeling a little better already." With Dr. Redwing's help, Punt got himself into a sitting position and fumbled for the pills that he carried in his jacket pocket. Dr. Redwing went to get a glass of water. She had noted the name, Dilaudid, on the packet.
"That's a hydromorphone," she said. "It's a good choice. Very fast-acting. You have to be careful, though. It can make you tired, and you may experience mood changes, too."
"I am tired," Punt agreed. "But I have found my mood to be remarkably unchanged. In fact, I will be honest with you, I am quite cheerful."
"Perhaps it's your investigation. It's probably been very helpful to have something to concentrate on. And you were saying to my husband that it's gone well."
"That is true."
"And when it's over, what then?"
"When it is over, Dr. Redwing, I will have nothing left to do." Punt got unsteadily to his feet and reached for his walking stick. "I would like to return to my room now, if you would be so kind." They left together.
Chapter 7 On the other side of the village, the police divers were emerging from the lake.
Raymond Chubb was standing on the grassy shore, watching as they dumped what they had found in front of him. He was wondering how Punt had known it would be there. There were three dishes, decorated with sea nymphs and tritons, a flanged bowl, this one with a